The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record. Master Ma is unwell. The pointer. One device, one object, one word, one phrase. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter. Still, this is gouging a wound in healthy flesh. It can become a nest or a den. The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. The intent is that you'll realize there's something transcendental. It covers the sky and covers the earth, yet it cannot be grasped. This way will do, not this way will do too. This is too diffuse. This way won't do, not this way won't do either. This is too cut off. Without treading these two paths, what would be right? Please test, and I'll cite this for you to see. The great master Matsu was unwell. The temple superintendent said, "Teacher, how's your venerable health been in recent days?" Master Ma said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." The verse, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, what kind of people were the ancient emperors? For 20 years I've suffered bitterly. How many times I've gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave for you? This distress is worth recounting. Clear-eyed students of the way should not take it lightly. The intent is that you'll have a place to enter." All of this is about that. To enter into the true self, our original state, before the appearance of any characteristic or name or attribute. What is it? Before the mind creates something, has an idea, creates a distance. I see you, you see me. All the many things have one single nature. And so the Buddha said, in our seeing each other, things are not as they appear. And so we use a device, an object, a word, a phrase to try and see. To try and see. The great function appears without abiding by fixed principles. Another translation says it does not keep to any rules. And so within Buddhist practice, there's lots of discipline, there are precautions, there's codes and monastic rules and things that we agreed that we're going to do together. But within all of that, all of it's constructed, created, right? Monasteries didn't exist somewhere in the world, in the ethos, in the universe, and then just showed up. We create them. And within all of those devices, ultimately it's to see that there is no fixed principle, that it's not about following a rule. And because we think dualistically, we can think, oh, that means don't follow any rule. There are no rules. Rules are irrelevant. I see you and you see me, and we are not the same. That seems obvious, self-evident. And so the Buddha said, things are not as they appear, but nor are they otherwise. Here we are, looking at each other. The root intent, the pointer says, is that we'll realize there's something transcendental. There's something right here, all the time, that is beyond, as the Buddha said, right after his enlightenment, beyond what we can grasp with our thinking mind, beyond what we can measure, beyond what we can know with our big ideas. And what does all this have to do with today? Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. What does this have to do with today? Last week, a Sangha baby was born, Reuben. And so we rejoice, we look forward to the life of this little creature who's just joined us. And this week, a friend, a monastic, a senior, passed away from this world. And so we grieve, we mourn a life passed by. When someone is born, we study their face, their eyes, their hair, if they have any. We begin to look for signs of the person, their personality. What are they like? We give them a name. We assign them a gender, a race. We begin to put together a little package for them. We begin to imagine a life for the baby. Who are they going to be? What are they going to do? What will their person be? What will they become? When someone is dying, we study their face, their eyes, their body. We look for signs of their transition. This person we've known so long, where are they going now? Where's that person now? And because of Yukon's particular form of cancer in his brain, it affected his speech, his language, the way he interacted. And so within that, we're not able to relate to him in the normal way. He was not able to relate to us in the normal way, in the familiar way, in the ways in which we could continue to recognize, oh, it's Yukon. And sometimes people would say, he's still there. It's still Yukon. And it's a natural thing to do. It's a natural thing to want to do, to still be able to see and connect with that person that we love. And it's also expressing something. There is someone, isn't there? Hasn't there been someone all along? Are they still there? And then once he passed, the body was there. But where was the person now? And part of recognizing all those characteristics at birth, all the way through, is, in a sense, seeing each person as unique. I mean, think about it. Think about yourself. There's no one in the whole universe at this time or ever in the history of the world who has existed who has been exactly you. That seems to qualify as unique. And in that, there can be a sense of appreciation and respect and dignity, regard. And we call that the self. And that is what he means in the point where the intent is that we'll find a place to enter into that. An inquiry. Is that so? Is that you? Master Hakuin said, a place to enter means an entryway for a student of the way. An entryway, a place to begin to enter in and investigate, examine, look around. Try and see what's really going on here. An entryway is for someone who doesn't want to just stand outside the door anymore. Imagining, conjecturing, ignoring. But somebody wants to enter in and find out what's in here. And this is just another way of talking about identity, all of these different characteristics of identity, how we identify ourselves, each other. In working with and being with Yukon over all these many years and working with him as a student, he early on would talk about Buddha study and how, you know, he'd never really been a good student and he wasn't that intellectual and he liked to read, but Dharma study, you know, just bewildered him and wasn't really into it. An identity. I'm not good at this. And so I encouraged him, offered texts for him to study, suggested he peruse different texts and just see what tickles your fancy, what pulls you in a little bit, what gives you a little spark Follow that enthusiasm. Because there's something about that that's you. There's a resonance. We all know him as a very buoyant, joyful person, loving person, playful. His name, Yukon, playful, perseverance. And I remember a point at which he came to me and started talking about how he of course knew that about himself, and he knew that that was the way other people saw him. And he began to realize that that was also how people expected him to be. Because it was so good, right? We wanted that from him. And he began to see other sides of that. And he said, you know, that's not all I am. And I said, I know. And he said, sometimes I just want to be quiet. He said, but I feel like sometimes people want me to be that way. And I said, trust yourself. I said, if people love you, and people love you, they will love you as you become more and more true to yourself. In this koan, Master Ma, Matsu was an early master, very early 800s, 700s rather, 8th century. And so if you think of Bodhidharma, very beginnings of the Zen tradition in China, and then Huainong, the sixth ancestor. And Huainong had two significant disciples. One was Qingyuan, whose lineage led down to what we call the Soto school in Japanese. And the other line was Nanwei, that went down to what we call the Rinzai, the Linji school. And Matsu was part of that line very early on. So here it says he was unwell, he was dying. And so the temple superintendent came to him and said, how's your health been? How are you doing? And Matsu said, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Now sun-faced Buddha, the sun-faced Buddha lives for 1,800 years, an eternity, essentially, infinitely long. Moon-faced Buddha lives for one day, short. So what did he mean? What was he pointing at when he said, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, how are you? The question was. One day in a talk, Matsu said, whatever forms you see, they're but the perception of your mind. But mind is not independently existent. It is codependent with form. It doesn't exist by itself. Nothing does. That's what the Buddha realized. It's one of the most profound realizations of his enlightenment. That everything is codependently arising. Nothing exists on its own, by itself. So Matsu is speaking specifically about mind here. And he said, you should speak appropriately about the affairs of your own life. For each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence. And your actions are themselves without hindrance. The fruit of the bodhisattva path is just thus, born of mind and then taking names to be form. How are you today? So there's youth, there's middle age, there's old, there's healthy, there's sick, there's dying. It's all sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. It's all here. So that question, how are you? The temple superintendent might have been asking, how are you feeling? How is your health? How is your illness? What are your symptoms? What do you need? Matsu knew that. But he was speaking in a way that was entering into the transcendental. All of that is true. All of that needs to be attended to. We want to take care of someone when they're sick. We need to know how they are. We need to know what will help them. But the Buddha said there is another sickness that is universal, the sickness of delusion. Matsu was bringing this out. Sun-faced Buddha lives an eternity beyond comparison, unborn, undying, seems to have no end in sight. Master Hakuin said, there will be a lot of fatalities if people take a view of emptiness to be sun-faced Buddha. He said, when I studied with my teacher, Shoju, and asked him about this, he told me to see through the next example, moon-faced Buddha. That's a very good there's a very good reason for this, Hakuin said. Moon-faced Buddha, how are you today? Tenkei Denson commented on this, said, but is everyone's own sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, something long or short? So the question of how are you is, in a sense, the same question as who are you? And the trick about asking that question is it presupposes there is a who, there is someone. If we attach to the face and the eyes and the voice and the personality, then we gain recognition, we sort of establish a basis for relationship, we get a sense of whether we like or don't like, is this a friend or a foe, does this person deserve our interest or not? But even if we love them with all our hearts, have we not in some way made them smaller? How can we see them and not deny any of those aspects? There is a moon-faced Buddha. And you're not cling, not solidify, not reduce a person to any of those aspects. There is a sun-faced Buddha. Whatever we see are but the perceptions of mind, and that is not independently existent. So when we look at a person and think that we're objectively just seeing that person, what Matsu is saying is no. In a sense, in those moments, we are like God, creating a being in our mind. And so he says, speak appropriately about the affairs of your own life. For each matter you encounter constitutes the meaning of your existence, and your actions are without hindrance. My understanding of this is appropriate means true, real, uncontrived. Speak appropriately. Speak in a way that's true. Constitutes the meaning of your existence, I understand, is meaning that this is the reality before our eyes. That we should speak appropriately in accord with what is true. In order to do that, we have to actually see what is true. And so just think about that in relationship to Zazen. So if what was true, truly, was what you thought in your mind, then we would sit here and just think and think and think and think and think and think and think. That would be the point, because that would be what is true. But we don't. We see that, all of that activity of mind, and we let it go. We release ourselves. We release it. We let go of our bondage to our thoughts. We, in a sense, liberate our thoughts so that we begin to see what is appropriate. Appropriate meaning what is true, because that constitutes the matter of our existence. That's the basis upon which there is a world. It's not as it appears. It's not just our biased perceptions, but nor is it otherwise. There is something there. It's not permanent and fixed. There is no permanent, abiding, independent self. But it's not utterly non-existence. You do have a name. You do have a personality. No one is suggesting that you, like, don't. So when the Buddha said that this path, this Noble Eightfold Path, is a middle way, to really reflect on how profound that is. I mean, think about anything, basically. Look anywhere and see how easy it is, how overwhelmingly prevalent and ubiquitous it is that wherever we look, whatever we see, things are falling down on one side or another. It's this or it's that. And that seems to be just the way things are first, until we start examining things. And in a way, it seems to make things very easy, because it's just like, okay, what side of the fence are you on? Get clear on that. Anybody on the other side of the fence, shoot. It's not so complicated. You're right and they're wrong. And so then think about how challenging it is to not go that way. What does that require? Well, think about the intent is that we have a place to enter. So we're dedicating this weekend to sitting. So you're sitting and something arises. A memory, a thought, an emotion, a sensation, a sound. And your mind immediately responds to it, impulsive consciousness. It somehow falls on that spectrum of liking or not liking. There's a, you know, an area of indifference. But mostly we dwell in liking and disliking, loving and hating. An emotion that arises that's strong and difficult. You'd rather not have it. You don't want to be the person having that. You don't want to be that angry person. And so to fall on one side or another is, are you an angry person or not? Right? If you're not an angry person, that's your identity. You got to put that somewhere, right? Because it's messing you up. It's messing up your portrait, right? So get rid of it. Hide it somewhere. But that's not what we do, because it's the middle path. And so we don't try and put it away, but we also don't just indulge it and get all embroiled in it, because we know where that goes. And that takes something to be able to do that. First, you have to want to. Why should you want to? Because to not do that, there will be pain and suffering. There will be confusion, right? We will spill that out onto others, right? And, you know, we can go a long part of our lives, people go a long part of their lives, and that's okay. That doesn't matter. Or it doesn't matter enough. But for practitioners, there has to be a point where it does matter. It's not okay anymore. That's not how I want to be. That's not the life I want to live. And even if it's bound up in my identity, that's not the kind of person I want to be. That's not how I want to see myself. That's not how I want you to see me. Provisionally, that can help. Work with that identity. And so we hold ourselves lightly, wakefully, in that moment, and try and sort of resist that impulse to just fall down on one side or the other, turn into this or turn into that. Be this kind of person or be that kind of person. And that doesn't take just a desire to do that, but it takes mindfulness, it takes patience, it takes some courage, it takes resilience, it takes stamina, it takes perseverance. Because you can't just do it once, right? You have to do it 1,000 times, 100,000 times. We have to do it every time it arises. And to live in what may appear as that a complexity, but it's actually not complicated. That's the thing. Samsara is complicated. Because everything has to get figured out and put into its proper category. And not seen as it is, which is simple and plain like water. And that's why those things that we do within ourselves, within our relationships, within families, communities, within nations, between nations, the longer that goes, and the more that falling onto one side or the other just sails along, the more complicated it gets. Until we find ourselves in situations where it's literally difficult to figure out, how could this ever be different? How could this ever change? How will this ever change? And in a sense, it seems to me, it has to come down ultimately to the middle way. People have to be willing to say, we're no longer going to resort to those extremes, to those dualities. We're going to change something new. We're going to do something different. And if we think about how all of this, in a sense, can be traced back, the seeds of it, to that beautiful little baby, right? That we start to, you know, dress up a bit. And of course, you know, and then we do that. We do that ourselves because we're the baby, right? And so we're getting all of those things. We recognize ourselves as all of those things. And so we have that sense of self. And that's okay. That's the thing. Just having a sense of oneself, having self-awareness, recognizing ourself as having certain characteristics, that's not a problem. People have always done that. Buddhist practitioners, enlightened beings. It's not that you just turn into some kind of amorphous blob of like clear jello, you know, with a nose. But we just don't delude those characteristics. We don't give them, infuse them with things that they don't actually possess, like solidity, fixedness, meanness. Oh, that's who I am. I do something good. It helps you. I'm a good person. Hallelujah. I do something bad. I hurt you. I'm a bad person. And yet to say it's all empty, as Hakuin says, we'll just litter the ground with fatalities. Well, just to be ignoring the fact that, yeah, I did something and it hurt you. And that has a reality. That's the profound nature of the middle way. In a sense, it doesn't deny anything. It just asks, what is it that we're not denying? What is it that we're not denying? What is its nature? And so all of these teachings, this language that is talking about self-nature and Buddha nature, self and other, perceptions, mind, it all comes down to how we create the world. When somebody asked the Buddha, what is the world? He said, it's you, it's your mind, it's your senses. It's all the ways in which we look out and see the world out there, and we look out and the world comes pouring in. And then that perceiving mind, which started very, very early accumulating history and memories and ideas and beliefs and examples and tinkers. The conditioned mind is a tinkering mind. It tinkers with stuff. It doesn't just leave things alone. It messes with everything. Nothing by itself is good enough. It's not good enough if we like it, and it's not bad enough if we don't like it. And so just think of when you're sitting, you're just letting, that's the mind that you're bringing to rest. That's the calming. Then we just stop tinkering. Stop messing with everything. See, not just what you experience, but how do you experience yourself when your mind is at rest? When we're no longer trying to manage and manipulate. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. What kind of people were the ancient emperors? There's a story that when this emperor in the 11th century, the Sung emperor of China, was on the throne, he thought that line was ridiculing the emperor, so he wouldn't allow it to be part of the canon, right? It's kind of interesting that the emperor's reading the Blue Cliff Record. I don't know. But of course, it's not about the emperor. What kind of people are we? For 20 years, I've suffered bitterly. How many times I've gone down into the Blue Dragon's Cave. The Blue Dragon's Cave, what did Dr. Roshi used to say? She used to talk about the psychological bilge. Right? The flotsam and jetsam. It's the stuff that's like floating around, the scrum, you know? In the dragon's cave, we have one at the door, right? And that dragon has a pearl. And to obtain that pearl, you have to mess with the dragon. Or rather, you have to stop messing with the dragon. It can't be taken by force. How many times have I gone down into this cave for you? Is this a teacher talking to the student? Or is this the student, the bodhisattva, speaking to all sentient beings? How many times have I gone down into the Blue Dragon's cave, into my own mind, wrestled with my own karma, let go of my own attachments? For who? For you. Not that you've asked me to, but that's what I want my life to be. And so, for whom are you sitting on this cushion? For whom do we take up Ongo practice? For whom did Yukon dedicate his life to the Dharma? This distress is worth recounting. What is it that motivates us? What is it that makes us want to go beyond the surface, to enter into that entryway, to see, to do what is, I mean, you know, you could be having a very different kind of weekend here, right? Just about anywhere. That's why before the first session, before coming into residency, before becoming a student, that question, why? Why do you want to go into this cave? What is the distress that is worth recounting? What is the distress that's worth actually facing? Distress can be a tremendous motivator. It is worth recounting. It should not be ignored. Use it. Clear-eyed students of the way should not take it lightly. The answers to these questions are not in the words. Words are beautiful, fleeting. They can also deceive us. The answers are in what we call practice, which is living. It's living the Dharma, bringing it alive in our mind and body. A student asked Master Matsu, what is the essential truth of Buddhism? And Matsu says, what is the essential truth of now? That's how close it is.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.